Welcome to Access Utah. This is Addison Pace. Last year, agricultural producers experienced the worst drought in generations. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced this week the department's vision for agriculture in the face of evolving environmental challenges. Today on the program, Sherry Quinn talks to USDA spokesperson Blake Walbeck about the challenges ahead for farmers and ranchers in Utah and discusses conservation stewardship funding available to producers in Utah and nationwide. Then Science Questions explores the novel Einstein's Dreams, a series of fictional stories dreamed by Albert Einstein through the music of singer-songwriter and author Randa Williams. He tells the stories in the books through songs he composed along with youth in Salt Lake City. This is coming up after the news. Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 2 with a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. The warmest year on record for the continental U.S. was 2012, according to a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report. We are seeing more severe storms and an increase in invasive species and political tensions brought on by food insecurity. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced Wednesday the federal government must increase collaboration and work more closely with farmers, researchers, and industry to develop new solutions that will help agriculture adapt to the modern challenges of climate change. The United States Department of Agriculture also released a short video showing ways they can help farmers, ranchers, and landowners. This clip includes meteorologist Brad Rippey and Mills of Natural Resources and Development and soil scientist David Smith.
Within the United States, we've seen some fairly dramatic changes adding up over the course of several decades. We live in a warmer and somewhat wetter planet than what we did a generation or two ago, and we expect to continue to see global climate extremes.
American forestry and agriculture can play a tremendous role in helping mitigate and adapt to climate change. And USDA brings significant resources to bear in terms of science, research, technical assistance, financial assistance, decision tools.
That's really important if we're going to invoke strategies to adapt to a changing climate. You need to understand where you're coming from to know where you're going.
For example, the 1930s Dust Bowl, a lot of lessons were learned. And so we will have to adapt to a different future.
And we are committed to helping agriculture and forestry be very much part of the solution to addressing climate change.
If you compare the 20th century climate with what we see presently, we have now run off a string of 338 consecutive global monthly average temperatures that have been above the 20th century mean. That means that the last time we saw a global monthly temperature that was below the 20th century mean was February of 1985. Certainly with the warmer climate, we have seen an increase in extreme weather events. We see more record highs, more record lows, precipitation that's heavier and falls in more extreme circumstances, and that can lead to more flash flooding. In the western United States, snowmelt is occurring much earlier than it once did, and that's a disruption to the activities of water managers. We have seen some shifts in agriculture. Crops are being grown in places that they weren't a generation ago.
America's farmers, ranchers, forest landowners, America's rural communities have been very resilient in the face of some very difficult weather events in the past. We think about recent droughts and floods, we think about wildfires. And what USDA is doing is working to help them manage through the risk and uncertainty of this changing climate in a way that allows them to continue to prosper. The Natural Resources Conservation Service is working side by side with farmers all over the country, helping them put into place voluntary conservation practices.
Joining us on the program today is Blake Walbeck, spokesperson for the Natural Resources Conservation Service based in Richfield, Utah. Walbeck oversees the Farm Bill programs and the USDA's Conservation Stewardship Program in Utah. The conservation program came out of the 2008 Farm Bill and is providing roughly $175 million in funding for agricultural acreage nationwide and is accepting applications for the funding until June 14, 2013. Walbeck talks about what the program offers and the challenges facing Utah, based on the effects of extreme weather events such as drought. Alfalfa is the largest crop in Utah, and we need more of it growing as feed for livestock. It also helps restore the soil because it adds nitrogen, but it requires irrigation.
Yeah, we could always use more. Water is the limiting factor. Utah has plenty of land. I mean, the Intermountain West has plenty of land. Water has always been the limiting factor.
What is the latest forecast for weather in Utah?
I looked at the most recent map this morning without getting into too much detail, but Utah can expect a year where the bulk of the state should expect stream flows for the spring and summer to be probably less than 69% of normal, and in a fair share of the state, they're predicting that stream flows will be less than 49% of average. That's an 81 to 2010 average. So I think water will be down this year. I mean, no doubt about that. Areas that have significant storage, of course, are better off than those that don't. The bulk of the areas in the state have at least some storage, but there are still areas that are subject to whatever the stream flow is. That's what they have, and once it drops off in even May or June, they're through irrigating for the year.
That includes much of San Pete, Willard, and Iron counties.
But many areas do have significant storage, or those areas where they have deep wells that supply their irrigation water or supplement their irrigation water supply, what they get in addition to stream flow. I mean, they will get by, but there's a lot of these folks that will have a pretty short water year, the way it's looking.
Some of the dry crops in Utah, like wheat and barley, will also suffer from the drought.
The dry farming is concentrated in a few areas in the state. Northern Utah, much more than anywhere else. Box Elder County, Cache County, Ridge County are typically big areas. Juab County, Millard County, a little bit in Washington County. But that is the bulk of the dry land in the state. But it is pretty significant, particularly in those big counties like Box Elder, that there's a lot of dry cropland in those counties.
Grazing is threatened too.
I mean, what you have is what you get. You get some benefit out of, you know, precip even now. You know, the winter typical precip season is over, but even rainstorms now would supplement that and help that immensely. And that applies to both private grazing lands and to the public grazing lands that are used widely in all of Utah.
Have you seen a decrease in the amount of cattle grazing?
Anecdotal, I know several people that have gotten out of the business, but I mean, the land has probably stayed in that land use. It stayed into ranching, stayed into farming, which it typically does. Probably the biggest threat to agriculture in Utah is urbanization. As sprawl moves out into these areas and takes the land out of production, that's lost forever for agriculture. And that's part of our goal as an agency, is to keep land in agricultural production to assist producers to maintain their resources, their soil, their water, their plants, their animals. And by doing so, that will help keep them in production and help keep that land in agricultural use.
In addition to drought, invasive species are another problem for agricultural producers the program aims to combat.
Typically in Utah, Russian olive, depending on where you go, introduced species, woody species that grows in our wet areas, in our river corridors, tamarisk or salt cedar. mostly in the southern eastern part of the state, but it's completely overtaken many of our corridors. If you're talking agricultural land, there's a number of non-woody species that have taken over, but it pretty well varies. Each county establishes their own invasive species list, the ones that they deem to be invasive and the ones that they want to concentrate on. In Cache County up in that area, Dyer's Woad is a big issue. We've yet to see it in this part of the world. It's an introduced weed. It's been in this part of the world for at least 30 years that I'm aware of, but typically in around Brigham City and at least the southern part of Cache County, if you go out this time of year and you see the yellow flowers up on the side of the hill, that's usually what it is, that it has a bright yellow flower on a tall stem. It was a problem on the dry cropland and now has invaded into the range. Later in the season, when it dries out, it has a dark blue, almost black seed head that you'll see on it. It'll lose its leaves, and mostly all you'll see is just those stems on it. But it is a problem once it grows into native range. It's difficult to deal with, and the costs become prohibitive. In a lot of cases, doing it, why prevention is usually a better fix than a cure.
They also implement strategies to manage wildlife issues for private landowners that include deer, elk, the sage grouse, and even pollinators. About 75% of the world's flowering plants, including two-thirds of all crops, must be pollinated in order to reproduce. Bees are the primary pollinators. Honeybees are the most well-known and used. Other bees, including bumblebees and solitary bees, also make a difference. All pollinators are in decline as a result of habitat loss, deterioration, fragmentation, and pesticides. Improving bee habitat on farms is encouraged.
There's been a big boost in this program, encouraging producers to put in pollinator habitat, to encourage pollinators to hang around, which helps not only their production, but it also helps adjacent with ornamentals if it's next to a community or orchards or whatever the case may be.
Another species currently threatened is the greater sage grouse. 44% of its habitat is lost to agriculture, urban development, and threats like wildfires.
We have a separate fund pool incentive program that provides incentive payments to producers to do conservation practices that benefit sage grouse. And typically that would be watering facilities, that would be marking fences. Fences are a big problem for sage grouse. They have a problem flying into them, that we put fence markers on them so that they can see them better in critical areas. But we do a number of things. It's one of our bigger programs that we have.
And for the Conservation Stewardship Program, there is no minimum acreage required for the funding.
If you're an agricultural producer, has control of the land for the 5 years of the contract, you're eligible. Last year, I know we did a contract that was less than 1 acre. Anyone is eligible. The basic requirements to be in the program is you must have control of the land, obviously. You don't have to own it, but you must have control of it via lease or other agreement for the 5 years of the contract. You must be in compliance with the highly erodible and wetland conservation provisions of the 2008 Farm Bill, and you must meet the adjusted gross income provisions of the Farm Bill, which basically is wide open because the only thing it says is you must not make more than $1 million off farm, which most of our producers in this part of the world do not. So that's the basic requirements of being in the program.
The goal of the program is to ultimately increase productivity as well as improve conservation on private agricultural land while maintaining a healthy ecosystem balance. Options available to farmers and ranchers include ways to improve soil. One example is through the use of organic crop covers that help restore depleted soil. Legumes are choice because they are high in protein and they add nitrogen. More fuel-efficient strategies, like using animal manure instead of commercial manure, save energy. And improving water systems for more efficient irrigation and for the preservation of threatened wildlife, such as the sage grouse. For more information about the Conservation Stewardship Program, go to the Utah NRCS website. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions.
The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
Sticking to a regular exercise schedule isn't easy. After all, there are plenty of potential hindrances: time, boredom, injuries, and self-confidence. But these issues don't need to stand in your way. Consider practical strategies for overcoming common barriers to fitness. Squeeze in short walks throughout the day. If you don't have time for a full workout, don't sweat it. Shorter spurts of exercise, such as 10 minutes of walking spaced throughout the day, offer benefits too. Choose activities you enjoy. You'll be more likely to stay interested. Remember, anything that gets you moving counts. Exercise with friends, relatives, neighbors, or coworkers. You'll enjoy the camaraderie and the encouragement of the group. Schedule exercise as you would schedule an important appointment. Block off times for physical activity and make sure your friends and family are aware of your commitment. Whatever you decide to do, stick with it and remember why you're doing it. Your heart will thank you. This is Dana for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
That was Randall Williams performing one of the songs he wrote based on Alan Lightman's book, Einstein's Dreams. Lightman, a poet, theoretical physicist, and prolific novelist in equal parts, is most well known for this first work of fiction all about time, The Fourth Dimension.
The way that we relate to time is the vehicle for exploring human nature.
Lightman reads from his book.
And this is the dream of the 14th of May, 1905. There is a place where time stands still. Raindrops hang motionless in air. Pendulums of clocks float mid-swing. Dogs raise their muzzles in silent howls. Pedestrians are frozen on the dusty streets, their legs cocked as if held by strings. The aromas of dates, mangoes, coriander, cumin are suspended in space. As a traveler approaches this place from any direction, he moves more and more slowly. His heartbeats grow farther apart. His breathing slackens. His temperature drops. His thoughts diminish until he reaches dead center and stops. For this is the center of time. Who would make pilgrimage to the center of time? Parents with children and lovers.
There is a place where time stands still. Raindrops hang motionless. Dogs howl silently.
Following suit in the genre known as magical realism, Lightman explores time, imagining what Einstein would have been dreaming about in the year 1905 in Bern, Switzerland, right before he comes up with his theory of relativity.
My own background, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and I did watch a lot of movies because my father owned movie theaters, and I could get into movies free, which was really impressed the 15-year-old girls that I was dating.
With a father who owned a movie theater and a mother who was a Braille typist and dancer, Lightman was destined for the arts, though his head was also in the stars.
The way that I was a little bit different is that I had an interest in both the sciences and the arts. And I had one group of friends who were my science buddies, and we would do chemistry experiments and set rooms on fire and that kind of thing. And then I had my artist friends. These were the friends who wrote poetry and wrote for the school literary magazine. And I was the only one who went back and forth between these two groups of friends. that made me a little bit odd. I think as I've gotten older, I've become more and more conscious of the fact that we live too fast, especially in the Western world, that our pace of life is too quick for our own good. So I prefer trying to imagine worlds in which time moves more slowly, or we take out more time to slow down and think about who we are and where we're going. So that's kind of a realization that has come in recent years after writing the book.
About halfway through the book, it picks up. A chapter about speed, where all is in motion. Houses and apartments are mounted on wheels and sailing down the streets. The air whines with the sound of motors and locomotion. When a person steps out of his front door at sunrise, they hit the ground running to catch up with their office building. In this world, time passes more slowly for people in motion, leaving no one sitting reading under a tree or gazing at the ripples in a pond. No one is still, but rather moving to save time.
That particular dream world happens to be the one that reflects the actual theory of relativity, where the faster you move relative to another person, the slower your clocks tick compared to that person's clocks. That one particular dream world is the one and only one that is based on the actual Einstein's actual theory of relativity, and all of the other ones are just made up.
The theory of relativity overturned the concept of motion from Newton's day by positing that all motion is relative. Time was no longer uniform and absolute, and physics could no longer be understood as space by itself and time by itself. Instead, an added dimension had to be taken into account with curved space-time. Lightman has made fundamental contributions to the theory of relativity, his focus being relativistic gravitation theory, with a significant discovery of a structural instability in orbiting disks of matter that form around black holes. It is from this place that Lightman arrives, a professor at MIT of both writing and physics, the first to hold a joint appointment in both physics and humanities.
Topic sentences are fatal in fiction. Because in fiction writing, you want your reader to participate in the scene that you're creating. You don't want to tell them a recipe at the very beginning for how to think about the trip. You want them to be blindsided and to become part of the creative process. I realized when I started writing fiction that my urge, my inclination to use topic sentences was my scientific side coming in, and I had to say, no, that's not right here. You have to be quiet and sit at the back of the bus for a while. So I have felt the scientific and artistic sides of myself battling with each other at times, and other times they come together and work together.
Einstein's Dreams is a timeless mystical book, a book of poetry where Lightman takes us into an emotional fourth dimension that seems to resonate with an obscure but common experience. It is a surprising book. If you started reading standing, you would end sitting, ensconced in something deep and soft. The physics of time is ever-present, but subtle, used to inform a philosophical journey into various worlds of time. In one world, time is a line that terminates at the present, where people cling to the present as if hanging from a cliff. In another world, time moves backwards. Overripe fruit hardens and returns to the tree. Old people grow young, regaining strength, energy, and life.
What if you had one more day? What would you say? Would you ask for that day? Or leave it alone? Years go by, leaving their traces behind. We are still just sitting here in time. What if you could pause right now?
That was 8th grade science students Emma and Saffron practicing in a stairwell at Salt Lake Arts Academy, a charter school in downtown Salt Lake, where Susie and I spent the afternoon talking to musicians, teachers, and students, all rehearsing for the upcoming performance that night at the Leonardo. Timing is everything, and Randall Williams is herding cats, helping a group of 15 to 20 students write the music to their own songs based on Lightman's book.
So, let's do, just for a second. So there's a chord, and now here's another chord, and here's another chord.
Is it like a country blues?
A country blues. What is this now? So it's blues. It's 12-bar blues. It's the same stuff that you guys did. I did the same exact thing. I made one of the songs in this cycle that I'm now getting paid for and people are downloading on iTunes, a 12-bar blues tune just like yours was. And what I did is I pulled a song out of this book that I liked, and I started playing this riff, and I grabbed the words just like you guys did. So just imagine I woke up this morning, saw time had stopped, went downstairs to tell my mom. You know, it could have just as easily been those lyrics. You see what I mean? So my creative process was the same as your creative process. Does that make sense?
That's cool.
So, but here's this other song that I did. Check this out. I did the exact same progression that you guys also did. I did that same thing. Check this out.
I'm Jen Hodge, and I'm the event producer.
I'm Jenny White, and I'm a science teacher. I teach 6th and 8th graders at the Salt Lake Arts Academy.
I'm Dina Matkowski, and I am 12.
I really like that a lot of it is focused on the arts. It's not just you have one class that maybe once a week to do an art, you have two classes.
What have you guys been studying about time?
We were talking about the space-time continuum, the fabric of space-time, and how at the center of a black hole, time stops, and how time, not only light warps, but time warps, and like things like that, and that we don't know when time started or what it actually is, so things like that. I found it really fascinating. A lot of times when it's about things we don't know, I really like the subject of those instead of learning about just sitting in a room learning about things, but when we're doing experiments, that's the fun part.
John?
Jamie?
And so what are you guys doing here this afternoon in this workshop?
We're just making music, and we're basing it off of time and how time flows, and we base the songs off of the theme of that time is short.
Yeah, so right now we're practicing for the performance. We so far got a lot of good songs. And yeah, so our band is about to play right now, so.
I woke up this morning, and I looked at the clock, and that's when I noticed that time had stopped. So I went downstairs, and I talked to my mom, and I told her a story about how time has stopped.
Good job.
All right, let's go back upstairs.
It was now late in the afternoon, the clock ticking, and they were down to the wire. A few hours remaining before the big show, and still some skills to hone.
You need to go up to the high D. It's a really hard one to hit. Try it. Have you ever improvised before?
But Dina and the Stairway Duo were ready to take to the stage alongside musician Randall Williams, a classically trained folk singer based in Maine and who travels the world performing his music. Susie sat down with Williams in the school music room. He had his guitar in hand and an open heart to share with us.
I'm Randall Williams, and I've come to Salt Lake through a couple different grants and also the Intermountain Acoustic Music Association to do a performance of Einstein's Dreams, and it's a musical cycle that's based on the novel by Alan Lightman.
I just was interested in having you to start by talking about your background as a musician.
I grew up with a Little Orphan Annie record. That's pretty well where it all started. My mom took me to go see Little Orphan Annie, and I was singing along, and soon I picked up a guitar and started playing folk songs. And then I was in a band for a while, and I went off to college and played some more music, and then I decided I was going to let all that go, but I really couldn't let it go completely, and so I went back to conservatory to get a degree in vocal music in Belgium, and then had a private teacher for a while, and then I decided that classical music wasn't really doing it for me. And so I think what I've come back to after leaving the conservatory and touring around the world, I lived in Europe for a while and have lived in the States now for 6 years consistently on the acoustic scene, playing clubs, bars, cafes, fine arts venues, that kind of thing. I think what I've come back to now is merging that classical sensibility with the acoustic folk stuff that I love so much.
Do you have a classical piece you could play at all, or anything you can play?
I have a classical piece that I could sing for you a cappella without piano. Would that work?
That'd be great.
So it's this little, I'll sing to you this little piece of this Italian art song from the 16th century, and I often joke that it's a Britney Spears song, because the lyrics say, basically, I love you, I love you, I love you, and if you don't believe me, cut my heart open, it's tattooed in there. And that's something that Gaga or Britney could have, you know, anyway.
Amarilli, mia bella. Non credio del mio cor, dolce desio, d'esser tu l'amor mio, credilo pur, e si ti morta sale, dubitar non ti vale, aprimi il petto, e vedrai scritto in cuore. Amarilli, amarilli, amarilli è il mio amore.
Wow. That was all he could say, wow.
You know, you just walk down the street, you wouldn't think that came out of you necessarily.
Yeah.
You're really sort of creating something new, I think, especially moving into the science realm with Einstein's Dreams. It's really interesting. I want to talk a little bit about, you said you're hyperactive. Did that end up taking you away from classical music onto your adventures? I think you've been a lot of places. You're very worldly. You even lived on a sailboat. Can you just talk a little bit about moving out of the classical world and going on your worldly adventures?
Yeah, the hyperactivity for me is something I grew up with and had a real struggle at managing as a kid. I was on and off of prescription drugs trying to figure it out. I was watching my friends use drugs and alcohol to try to figure it out. And I think that's my love for teaching, my love for students, especially at this age. I've taught almost every grade level. I've taught elementary, middle, high school, and college. And at different points. And I think my love for teaching and my love for engaging students is seeing all of that raw energy looking for a place to go. What I saw today in these 6th, 7th, and 8th graders were a lot of kids who are really bored by school and need the challenge. And these are kids who are exceptionally gifted. They've got all kinds of skills, and they just really need to be engaged. And so for me, the challenge wasn't school as much as finding ways that school could actually engage stuff that I was interested in. So I came very close to being inpatient for my depression and my hyperactivity. Came very close to them locking me away in a facility. And how I was saved by a teacher at an alternative school who looked at me and said, "What's your dream? What is it you want to do?" And we had this opportunity in the last half of our high school, in the last half of our senior year of high school, to do whatever we wanted. And I wanted to go to Europe. And I said, "Well, I want to go to Europe." And she looked at this kid who was inches away from being hospitalized, whose friends had committed suicide, who were bringing knives to school, who were doing drugs. She looked at this kid and she said, "How are we going to get you there?" And the "we" part of that just electrified me. And I got all excited because I knew that I had an ally who was going to help me do it. And so as a senior in high school, I went off to Europe. And it was helping me engage the challenges that I was already ready to engage, because I had a lot on the ball. I just couldn't channel it into a way that the education system could take me in. And so that sparked my taste for adventure. When I went off to college the following year, I said, "How can I get back to Europe?" I was immediately plugged into the foreign language program. I went back to Europe several times, went to North Africa. And the day I graduated from college, I got on a plane to go to an orientation to work in Japan. And I worked in Japan for a while, went back to Europe, and while I was there, chose to move into a sailboat and sail off to Africa without any sailing experience.
How did you come across the book Einstein's Dreams? And what do you know about Alan Lightman?
Well, I came across Einstein's Dreams when it was given to me in 2003. I fell madly in love with the book, and I read it again several years later, and then was in a bookstore the summer before this cycle started to happen, a little bookstore in western Massachusetts called the Montague Book Mill, and the slogan is "Books you don't need in a place you can't find." It's out in the middle of nowhere. And I saw it, and I remembered it, and I loved it, and I wanted to share it with my friend that I was with, and so I bought a copy so that we could read it together. And while I was reading it, I had this gig with the Bijou Orchestra in Bay City, Michigan. Leo Najjar was the conductor, and he and I talked about doing a cycle together. And after that gig that I did with them, we did a fireworks gig, 100,000 people on ABC TV and fireworks going off. It was really quite the production. And after the gig, we were all sitting around over pizza, and Leo said, "You know what I'd really like to do? I'd like to do a cycle of songs." And I said, "Well, I'm in the middle of reading this great book, Einstein's Dreams. What if I started writing that cycle?" And his only question was, "Can it be a whole evening of music?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he said, "Let's do it." And so we sat down to work on it together, and he had ideas, and he decided to come up to Maine to meet me. And I called Alan Lightman, and I told him that I'd be very interested in meeting him for lunch. And he said, "I can't meet you. I'm not in Boston in the summer. I'm in Maine." And I said, "Well, where in Maine are you?" It turns out he was 10 minutes down the street from my house. So Leo Najjar came up with his wife, Regina, and we all met for lunch with Dr. Lightman, and I played him the few songs that I had written already, and he smiled this big smile. You know, you're always nervous. You play that. You say, "Look, I've written songs about your book. I hope you like them." And he smiled this big smile, and he says, "That sounds great. I'd love to do whatever I can to support this becoming reality." And so with that, Leo and I went off to, I to compose and Leo to orchestrate, and I wrote the remainder of the songs, except for two of them, which Leo wrote, and Leo did the orchestrations for all of them, and we premiered it in February of 2011 in the State Theater in Michigan. There was a video projection behind us, and it went from genre, it went all the way from classical, sort of neoclassical, all the way through heavy funk with a rock and horn section.
The series of meditations in the book, I call them meditations. Do you have a favorite, or do you have one that really sticks with you?
The one that really sticks with me is The End of the World. And I never knew why, but when we were in the studio recording the studio version of this CD, the producer looks up at me after we were done tracking the vocals. He says, "Yeah, right. That would never happen." In The End of the World, the vision that Dr. Lightman's created in this book is that people all join hands because everyone knows the exact moment when the world's going to end. And as it gets closer and closer and closer, these people start doing things like saying hello to their neighbors, or going swimming naked in the fountains of the city, or meeting people they've never met and walking with them hand in hand. And at the end of the world, everyone holds hands, they form a giant circle, and they're all still together. And my producer looks at me and says, "That'll never happen. They'll be looting and rioting." The vision that Dr. Lightman created of the way things could be if we all knew, of how we would all join together despite all of our differences, is, I think, the juice that made Einstein's Dreams the bestseller that it is.
That's wonderful. I thought when I read that chapter, I really thought about how maybe the most vivid and alive living happens closest to death.
Leo Najjar died the day after he finished the recording. And it was personally and professionally devastating. And in the months that followed, as I tried to recover and played the concerts that he and I were going to play together by myself, needing to bring this project, his project, to life, and feeling like life can be very, very short, really struck home for me. And today, the girls who wrote the song, there were two girls who wrote a song, and the lyrics were, "What if we all had a clock inside of us? Would we know when that clock would stop?" These eighth graders have no idea what they're saying, but yet they do.
Would you mind playing that song? Can you play it?
Not at all. The world will end on 26 September 1907. Everyone knows it. In the city of Bern, it's the same as in all other cities. One year before the end, schools close their doors. Why learn for the future with so brief a future? Delighted, children play hide-and-seek in the arcades, skip stones on the river, squander their coins on peppermint and licorice. Their parents let them do what they wish.
How do you feel about Einstein? Einstein.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed getting to know Einstein through this and through reading the Isaacson biography. There have been a number of statements about creativity being more important than fact that I like a lot because it's such a big thinker. I mean, Einstein was developmentally disabled. I mean, let's just be clear about that. Einstein had Asperger's. He had the same thing that, you know, it's on the same continuum with ADHD, the stuff I've got. He didn't fit in well in school.
Nope.
You know, he was struggling to hold down a job when he finally got, his friend finally set him up with this patent clerk gig that he got in Switzerland. He graduated from college and spent 3 years being homeless with his wife, who was also a cousin of his, pregnant. And then he doesn't know what the heck he's going to do. And his friend scores him this job in this patent office where he has to travel to Switzerland to be there. And he finally gets this job where he's working down the street from the Swiss clock that all clocks would later run by, in the patent office where the patents were rolling in around how they were going to synchronize time over distance.
Wow.
I find it incredible.
He just has an incredible style, an incredible way of communicating with the kids that shows that he really gets it at their level. And he can reach the girl who is hard to pull out of her shell, as well as the boys who are wanting to jump off the ceilings. And he knows how to reach everyone in a way that really pulls them in and keeps them engaged.
Jenny White is a science teacher at the school where she integrates science with dance, visual arts, theater, and music. Her friend Jen Hodge is a classically trained folk musician who wears many hats in the community. Aside from being a freelance musician, she's the educational director for Hawkwatch International. Hodge conceived of and brought this Einstein Streams event to Salt Lake City. Susie interviewed Ms. White and Ms. Hodge pre-performance.
I met him 6 years ago, maybe, and I've kind of followed his career. And when he started doing this Einstein Streams song cycle, he very early on in his writing of this piece, he shared one of the pieces with me. And it touched my heart in a way that not a lot of music does. And I just went, oh, I have to help this guy. And so when he had the full cycle done and had the first few performances of it, I've been looking for ways to help him make it real in the world. And there was a grant from the Utah Division of Arts and Museums, which I applied for. We got some money so that we could do this workshop and so that we could do the performance at the Leonardo. And it's just been a beautiful thing to work with him and to see him in action, because he is a very special person.
Now there's a woman crouched in the shadows. Now that's an odd place to be. People walking past stare at her, so she moves to beat the heat. But she's afraid to kick up dust as Peter Clausen walks across the street. 16 April 1905, on his way to the apothecary. You see, Clausen is a bit of a dandy, and if he stops to brush his feet, he may not get the ointment for his wife, and her legs have been aching for weeks. But then she won't go to Lake Geneva on June 23. She won't introduce her son Richard to Mademoiselle d'Epinay, and then Richard and Catherine won't marry on December 17th. They won't give birth to Friedrich, and Friedrich won't have his baby. But without Friedrich's little boy Hans, the world would change, you see, because the European Union of 1979 might never come to be. So she's walking on tiptoe, tiptoe.
Salt Lake Arts Academy Choir.
She's walking on tiptoe, tiptoe. She's walking on tiptoe, tiptoe. She's walking on tiptoe, tiptoe. She's walking on tiptoe. She's walking on tiptoe. Okay, you get it. So can somebody else tell the story?
What I don't get is how she knows what will happen in the future.
Aha! How does she know what's going to happen in the future?
We have to seize it and just do it. And so I love inquiry-based models for that reason, where you just kind of throw a problem at them and make them sit in it. And they'll get a little confused and frustrated until they start to do it. And they figure it out, and they give you results. I threw them a problem in the workshop yesterday. Write a song. And it was amazing how they responded to it. Now, some of them responded by going, too scary, no, I can't do it. But some of them were done with the song before 5 minutes went by. you know, it's, oh, you're already done? What the heck?
As I watch these children write these songs, they're also writing songs about how time is short. In spite of the fact that they think time can drag by, they also recognize that there are times when time is really short. When they're doing the things they really want to do, time is short. And I know that if that is self-evident at their age, there's got to be some truth to that.
With her backup band, Randall Williams on guitar, a cellist, and a drummer.
It is a surge. looking at all of these different theories of time through different lenses, through different songs that have different feelings to them. There are ballads, there are, you know, more raucous numbers, and you'll be swept away. I think the audience will be completely swept away.
She will be born, study at gymnasium, show her paintings and stuff. Again, she'll meet her husband, and they'll go sailing on a warm day.
One of the great pleasures of writing or of creating anything artistic is to impact other people and to stimulate their own creativity. And especially I love to see young people stimulated and exploring their own creativity. And if I can play a small role in that, I'm delighted.
This was a fairy tale public ed story where authors, scientists, teachers, radio people, musicians, students, and the Leonardo Science and Art Center came together to create, sing, include, and imagine with Einstein at the epicenter.
Do you have a favorite Einstein quote?
That the most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It lies at the cradle of true art and true science.
Alan Lightman published his seventh work of fiction titled Mr. G, a story of creation told by God who lives in a void, a place of emptiness without time or space. Mr. G, G is lowercase, decides out of boredom to create the world.
It has both joy and tragedy in the book. Mr. G is all-powerful, but he's not all-knowing, and he can't always predict the consequences of what he creates. And he's actually distressed to find that his universe contains suffering. And there's a fair amount of comedy in the book as well, but it's a serious book about science and religion and philosophy. I think that religion and science are the two greatest forces that have shaped human civilization, and I think they're both here to stay.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening. Special thanks to Randall Williams for his amazing talent in the classroom, and to Jen Hodge for making this Einstein's Dreams event a success, and for making this radio program possible.
In this world, time's a local thing. Farther apart, more out of sync. Every heartbeat, every desire, every cormorant wing, harmonized with every pendulum swing. And the only one who sees everything is the one who will never go home again. Yes, the traveler travels on. traveler travels on. In one city, people live closely, in another, far apart. In one city, people dress down, in another, they wear no clothes at all. Beyond the mountains or the trees, are lives that do not speak to each other.
Waste not. Do not overwater your grass. If the grass bounces back a few steps later, then things are just fine. If your footprints stay halfway or all the way down, then it's time to drag out the hose. Though we suggest checking to see if rain is in the forecast first.
Waste Not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.
A new water report from the National Resource Conservation Service says Utah's precipitation in May was below average across the state, and reservoir storage is 15% less than last year.
The whole state really is in a state of moderate to severe drought, and you know, you go into southern Utah and it's closer to the severe levels.
That's Jason Curry. He's with the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. He says despite these dry conditions, Utah's looking better in terms of wildfire danger this year than last.
Fuel moisture last year at this time in the grasses, it was somewhere around 4 to 5%. This year, last I heard, and it varies based on where you're at in the state, but it's in the teens.
Another indicator is sagebrush.
Sagebrush last year was peaking in its moisture levels around the last part of May. And so then it began to dry out in June and got even drier and drier as June progressed on. This year, the moisture levels in sagebrush is peaking right about now.
The higher water levels in grasses and sagebrush at this time of year is encouraging, says Curry. He adds it's predicted to be a normal to above normal fire season this year, but Mother Nature is ultimately in charge.
The things that go into fire danger are obviously high temperatures, dry fuel moistures, and then the big factor is wind. And we will probably see some days that are hot, dry, and windy. So that's kind of the magic combination in terms of volatile fire behavior.
The majority of fires in May and June are caused by humans, says Curry.
For example, last year, at about the middle of June, I think 97% of all fires at that point had been human-caused, just because we don't get a lot of lightning-caused fires this early.
So far, there have been approximately 130 fires, almost all of them smaller than 100 acres. Last year, there were twice as many by this time. For Utah Public Radio, I'm Kim Shusky.
This Saturday, June 8th, the Utah State University Museum of Anthropology in its Saturdays at the Museum series is exploring the world of puppetry.
We're going to be focusing on the world on a string, puppetry traditions from around the globe. And we have at 1 p.m. Susan Niedert, who is the director of the World of Puppetry Museum in Brigham City. And she's giving a presentation on the history and the traditions of puppetry around the world. And she's also bringing a bunch of examples from their museum of puppets from around the world.
Deputy Director and Curator at the Museum, Elizabeth Sutton, explains that the purpose of the Saturdays at the Museum series is to promote awareness and diversity.
And we thought it was interesting just because we're an anthropology museum and we try as much as possible to kind of highlight different cultures around the globe in order to create awareness and promote diversity. And we think it's going to be a lot of fun because throughout the day we'll be open from 10 to 4 and kids can come and make their own puppets and even put on puppet shows as well.
Admission is free and open to the general public. Funding for this event was provided by a grant from the United States Institution of Museum and Library Services. For Utah Public Radio, I'm Addison Pace.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.